This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The scandal at Abu Ghraib prison has had some very real consequences. Several low-ranking soldiers face court-martial. A brigadier general has been reprimanded. Her military career is effectively over. A three-star general has been passed over for promotion. More is expected. Still, important questions remain. Little is known about the CIA's involvement in Abu Ghraib or about what happened to as many as 100 so-called ghost detainees, prisoners the CIA hid from the Red Cross. We know little about what happened at prisons other than Abu Ghraib. Critics say that the investigations conducted so far don't go far enough up the chain of command, and some members of Congress call for a 9/11-style commission. In just a moment, we're going to take you to Abu Ghraib, so if you have questions about what's changed there, about the treatment of detainees, training, or whatever, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send questions by email, TOTN@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll get an update on investigations into the abuse scandal and talk with two retired generals, one who participated in the investigation of Abu Ghraib, another who wants an independent commission. First, we turn to NPR producer J.J. Sutherland, who arrived at Abu Ghraib prison earlier today for a tour of the facility. He's with us by phone from Abu Ghraib. Thanks very much for being with us, J.J.
Thank you, Neil.
What does it look like? Describe where you are.
Well, I'm standing in a car park right outside a hard facility, which is a warehouse where they sort of stripped out a bunch of trash and made a new hospital, made, you know, sleeping quarters. I took a tour earlier of the facility. Abu Ghraib is actually, when you think of it, it's not necessarily a large prison. It's actually about over 200 acres of dusty, gravelly area, and they have a number of fenced-in enclosures where they are keeping the prisoners there.
So prisoners aren't in a cell block, but in these enclosures?
They're in these enclosures. They have tents in these enclosures that are air-conditioned and heated now. They weren't before, but the new facilities that they built there. There are a number of different camps. There's Camp Redemption and Camp Liberty, and you know, people are, depending on their security level, are kept at different places.
Now, as I understand it, you're going to be spending the evening there at Abu Ghraib. What exactly are you going to be doing?
Well, I just took a tour of the facility with General Miller, who is now in charge of the prisons in Iraq. I looked at how they're doing interrogations now and how it's changed, and talking to some of the psychologists here who are dealing with the changes in interrogation techniques, and I'll be interviewing General Miller in the morning.
Well, I understand also there with you is Colonel David Quantock, the 16th Military Police Brigade Commander. I was wondering if you could hand him the phone.
Sure, here he is.
Thanks very much.
This is Colonel Dave Quantock.
Colonel Quantock, thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
As I understand it, you were assigned to Abu Ghraib last January. What problems did you see there and identify at that time?
Well, there were a number of areas that we saw problems with. One of the areas was, of course, medical. Had very little medical care for the detainees. The facilities, a lot of problems with facilities. For example, the tents and the triple-strand concertina and a lot of things. There was no electricity or anything like that going into the camps. But that's typical when you move into an operation, a tactical operation. We talked about, we found the quality of life for detainees was poor. But again, when you're in a tactical setting, when you first come into an operation, there are limited things that you can do. The standards of some of the soldiers were lacking. We saw that. And there's some training deficiencies and a lack of personnel for the units. As they went through OIF-1, there was a attrition of forces, and that caused a shortage of personnel.
One of the things we read about in the Schlesinger report, that's the major investigation thus far into the scandals at Abu Ghraib, and much more about that later, but one of the things we read about in that report was that part of the problem was a ratio of guards to prisoners of 1 to 75. What is it now?
Well, we're probably close to 1 to 8 or 1 to 10. As we've gone through and reduced our population, one thing you have to, at a tactical level, you know, military police doctrine has when you're in a combat situation, the typical solution is for every company it can secure 2,000 detainees. Now, when you look at the number of companies, they had five companies in there. By doctrine, they could secure upwards of 10,000 detainees. But in reality, when you don't have all the training that's required, and then you keep the detainees for longer periods of time, that becomes a more and more difficult proposition.
One of the things that we've also read about and heard about was that a lot of these detainees were picked up by American troops and brought to Abu Ghraib. Has there been a way to sift through who's really under investigation for actual crimes? Have people been let go?
Well, since we've got here the 31st of January, we've released over 7,500 detainees. I will say that when we first got here, there was probably, when you're conducting combat operations, at times the soldiers are out there under very difficult conditions, and a lot of times it's hard to tell the difference between friend and foe. So you have a tendency to grab a number of people and put them in detention facilities. However, we have worked extremely hard. The divisions have worked extremely hard at when they capture somebody, that they've got the documentation required, and that's a mandated requirement when detainees are brought to our facilities, that they have statements, pictures, captured documents to make sure that we really have grounds to hold this detainee. So from a quality of control of bringing detainees into our facilities, we've improved a thousandfold from where we were back in January.
And again, going back to the criticisms we've read about earlier, there was a lack of clarity, I think is probably a polite way of putting it, between the responsibility between the commander and military intelligence. Have all of those been resolved?
Absolutely. Right now we have Task Force 134. Task Force 134 is commanded by Major General Miller. And there are parallel chains that go directly to General Miller. For example, myself, I have the detainee operations, which I'm responsible for custody and control, and I report directly to General Miller. The military intelligence, the JITC, Joint Interrogation Detention Debriefing Center, reports directly to General Miller. The medical hospital reports directly to General Miller. All of the different facets, all the parallel organizations, report directly to General Miller. So there's no confusion on whose responsibilities there are.
We're speaking with Colonel Dave Quantock, the 16th MP Brigade Commander at Abu Ghraib Prison outside of Baghdad in Iraq. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255 or email us totn@npr.org. And Michael joins us on the phone from Ashburn, Virginia.
Hi, glad to be on the show.
Thanks for calling.
You know, I'm a historian of the modern Middle East, and I've just recently been reading about what occurred at the My Lai massacre in 1968. And what is very revealing but also haunting is how much is the same. The investigative reports, both that the Army did at the time, well, basically they were all Army, but Congress did a few, suggested very similar things, that it was ill discipline, that there was a lack of clear explanation of what the orders were, that the Army clearly had very strict orders. They weren't being carried out because of a failure of the officer corps, and that the overall political climate of a confusing and an unpopular war were contributing to this kind of a thing. And then we saw back in the early 70s, more or less whitewash. One of the things I wanted to ask was, has General Miller himself issued directives that have led to some of these improvements in the conditions? Because certainly in the case of My Lai, that was one of the problems, was that what changes were made came only after all of this external pressure.
Colonel Quantock?
Well, I can tell you that when we came here, I did a pre-deployment site survey in November, and I could see that there were problems with discipline. The standards of the organization that were here were lacking. And I'd gone back and looked at an investigation that had been conducted on a riot and looked at some of the findings of that. Based on those findings, we initially started to put together a list of those things that we needed to fix as soon as we took over operations. That had nothing whatsoever to do with what we found out going on in January when the story we started to hear what went on. And then from those findings that I took from past inspections, we put together a list of the things we needed to fix, and then when we got in here, we started conducting what we call in-progress reviews, IPRs, on a weekly basis to attack all the problems that we saw. And then, of course, we did hear in that time that some of the findings that were coming out in the investigations, and we plugged in pieces there to also fix those problems. But there was no whitewash. There was no going back and fix it just because. I mean, military organizations, we pride ourselves on getting better every time there's a switch out. I replaced another commander. My goal is to make it better than the person that had it before. And then somebody's going to replace me in the December, January time period, and that commander's priorities is going to make it better than what I had it. So everybody is trying to get better. But I don't see any parallels with what the listener was talking about.
Michael, thanks very much for the phone call.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk now with Jeremy. Jeremy calls from Ypsilanti, Michigan.
Yes. Hello, Colonel.
Yes.
My question is, I know that the military has a policy with the arms room where you can't take the photographs. I was wondering, is this a policy with the prisons, and was it just not being enforced, or is it something they're considering to do since, given how the photographs have been effective from Abu Ghraib?
And these, of course, the...
I'm sorry. Could you repeat the question?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think the question is basically, are photographs allowed still at Abu Ghraib prison?
Well, of course, photographing of detainees is absolutely forbidden, particularly, and we enforce that extremely hard. But I got to tell you, this is a data age, and it's almost impossible to preclude that from ever happening. But obviously, it's against the Geneva Convention to take pictures of detainees, and we are extremely harsh on that, and we enforce it that rule vigorously.
Jeremy, thanks.
We're tough on it, but try to eliminate it completely is going to be tough in this age.
Jeremy, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Colonel, I wanted to ask you, private contractors played a role in some of the abuses reported from Abu Ghraib. Are they still used as interrogators or as translators?
Yes, they are. We couldn't do our mission translation-wise without contracted employees. Again, I don't work on the interrogation side, so I don't know the numbers. I do know that they are, they do have some contracted interrogators over there. But for the numbers, I don't know. But I know they've been extensively trained and retrained in preparation for this mission.
And just a minute or so left with you, but obviously the terrible images from Abu Ghraib will never go away. Your job is to run things there now. Is there anything you can do to try to repair the terrible damage that's been done?
Well, we try and do that by getting better every day, by constantly trying to improve what we do here. Our soldiers take tremendous pride on where they were when they got here and where they're going. I'm tremendously proud of what our soldiers do. No, we can never repair the pictures, but we sure as heck can make a difference in the lives of detainees and the lives of our soldiers every single day that we're here. History will be the final judge, but I know from my focus day to day here at Abu Ghraib, it's to make the quality of life better for detainees, to make the quality of life better for my soldiers, and to accomplish the mission. And we do that by getting better every single day.
Colonel Quantock, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Colonel David Quantock is the 16th Military Police Brigade Commander, currently in charge of detainee operations at Abu Ghraib and other American-run prisons in Iraq. And he joined us from Abu Ghraib prison. When we come back from a short break, we'll bring you an update on what's been happening with the investigations into Abu Ghraib and whether a 9/11-style commission is needed. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email us, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about Abu Ghraib and the government's response to the prisoner abuse scandal, and we want to hear from you. call if you have questions about what the government's doing to investigate prisoner abuse and if you have questions about the causes and culprits of Abu Ghraib. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us to bring us up to speed on what's been going on in terms of the investigations is Michael Hirsch, senior editor at Newsweek magazine. He's been following the story and kind enough to brief us from time to time here on Talk of the Nation. Nice to have you back, Michael.
Thanks, Neil. Good to be back.
Summarize for us, if you will, there's a dizzying number of completed and still ongoing investigations underway.
Yeah, no, there certainly are. And in fact, Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, the other day used the sheer numbers of investigations as a way of fending off a call for a really big 9/11 commission style investigation, which human rights activists and increasingly numbers of military lawyers are calling for to really get to the bottom of what happened.
And there have been calls for that, some at the most recent hearings held last week by the Senate and House Armed Services Committee. We'll get back to that in a minute. But the a principal unanswered question involves the Central Intelligence Agency and so-called ghost detainees.
That's right. This came out particularly at the hearing on September 9th, the one-day hearing held by the Senate Armed Services Committee, when General Kern, who was the sort of the supervisory authority on the Army's own investigation into military intelligence, essentially admitted that he had gotten very little cooperation from the CIA in terms of them turning over documentation so that they could get to the bottom of who and where these detainees are. Essentially, what's happened is the CIA has taken control of a number of detainees in Iraq and elsewhere, secreted them away, in some cases so rendered them to foreign governments, and appears to be conducting interrogations according to its own rules. And the Army simply is not able to get information from them. And it was quite striking that someone as senior as General Kern found himself essentially stonewalled by the CIA on this.
And any progress on when we may find out anything about what's going on with these ghost detainees? The one thing we did learn was that there may be up to 100. That's the first number we've heard.
Well, that's right. They were quite variable on the numbers, anywhere from a couple of dozen up to 100, as Kern said. Which, of course, was just further evidence that they simply don't know what's going on there. Well, the CIA's own inspector general is conducting an investigation, but that's supposed to go on for some months, and it's unclear, given the classified nature of the way CIA handles its internal probes and its own documents, it's really unclear how much of the results of that investigation will become public ever. So yes, this is a very large stone left unturned in this matter.
Now, the conclusions of the major investigation thus far, the Schlesinger report, if you will, was that there were terrible abuses, the so-called animal house on the night shift at Abu Ghraib. Those are blamed for, well, the pictures we've all seen, the hooded man with electrodes connected as he stood on a box, the man with the leash being held by a private first class Lindy England, those pictures. But there were other abuses that went on at Abu Ghraib that did involve military intelligence interrogations.
Unquestionably. And I think the key issue out there, and what has human rights activists, as well as some investigators on the Senate side, and in many current and certainly retired military lawyers concerned, is that they perceive that there's still something of a whitewash going on, that the impression in the public mind left particularly by James Schlesinger himself, who, upon completing his commission's report, seemed to disown a lot of it and came out in defense of Donald Rumsfeld, that the impression left is that this was, as you call it, animal house on the night shift, when in fact the Schlesinger commission's own report documents how much of this was actually going on as part of procedure and policy. And that's what you're seeing from the Bush administration, an attempt to paint these investigations as determining that this wasn't administration policy, when there is clear and compelling evidence that it was.
Let's get a caller involved in the conversation. Mohammed joins us from Albany, Georgia.
Yeah, this is Mohammed. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Good to hear you. I listen to your show all the time.
Thank you.
My question is, if the Iraqi government has its sovereignty and no one to international as their sovereign government, shouldn't they take the control of their own prison then?
Well, yeah, but that sort of requires us to go back to the premise of your question, which is, do they have sovereignty? And the answer is no. They have, at best, partial sovereignty. The United States military, in effect, runs the country. Iraqi army and police forces are not even being close to being up to speed in terms of policing and defending their own country.
Well, then,
so you really don't have sovereignty.
Well, they don't have sovereignty. And why then the United States all the time, you know, they say they have their own sovereignty, they make their own decision, and they come, you know, the Bush administration saying all kind of stuff just to justify their
interim
of the country.
Mohammed, there's an interim government in
well, the
in
interim
Iraq.
Government is not sovereign, so they can't make a decision then.
There clearly is more sovereignty, more authority being wielded by Iraqis, and particularly Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, than there was before June 28th, when the Coalition Provisional Authority, Jerry Bremer, America's viceroy, were in charge. I mean, clearly they are doing more to run their own affairs. One of the things that's happening now, for example, is that the U.S. military is at least taking some direction in terms of deferring to Alawi's wishes in the negotiations with some of the insurgents. So they do have more control. It's just that
If they don't have control of the prisons, then is the army run also the other intelligence agencies beside the prisons, and when they investigate and do any
I think the key thing to remember here is that the Iraqi government has no indigenous security and military force of its own. The United States military is effectively providing that, and that is why Abu Ghraib and security roundups and detention operations are still under control of the U.S. military.
Mohammed's point, I guess, is made by the fact that the Iraqi government has just nominal control over its most infamous prisoner, of course, Saddam Hussein. Mohammed, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Here's another caller on the line. Allison is with us from Albany, Oregon.
Hi.
Allison, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I wanted to ask, when I first heard this scandal break, there was reporting about some of the women and the rape and things that was going on in the prison against the women in terms of how their treatment. But since then, I haven't heard a single thing. And I was just wondering, has there been any further investigation in that, or is anyone still looking into the treatment of the women in prison?
Yeah, I mean, that is part of the investigation. I will say, from what I know about the ongoing cases being investigated and prosecuted, that there weren't that many cases of rapes of women. There were several cases of sodomizing Iraqi boys by some of those involved, not necessarily U.S. soldiers. But there were only a handful of allegations involving the mistreatment or rape of women.
Allison, thank you.
Thank you.
Michael, stay with us. Joining us now is retired General Joseph Hoare, former CENTCOM commander, and he joins us by phone now from his office in Del Mar, California. General Hoare, thank you very much for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here, Neil. Thank you.
And I wanted to get your response to the two major investigations of Abu Ghraib that were made public. I know you've called for a 9/11-style commission to investigate. How come?
Well, I think, first of all, there have been many investigations, and they've all been piecemeal, and not one has been comprehensive and independent. Comprehensive in the sense that there's far more to this, as you suggested here a few moments ago, than just what's been going on within the uniform military. There is an aspect that has to do with the civilian leadership of the Department of Defense. And now CIA, and based on what the author Seymour Hersh has told us over the weekend, there's an indication that some of this material was brought to the attention of Ms. Rice, the National Security Advisor. And so this is far larger than just the people that have been associated with the security and interrogation of prisoners. So there needs to be, first of all, a comprehensive investigation on the 9/11 lines. And secondly, it needs to be independent. And I'm not for a moment suggesting that Jim Schlesinger and Harold Brown and their colleagues didn't do a good job. But an investigation that is activated by the Secretary of Defense to look at the Department of Defense is of its very nature not independent. It needs to be an outside group in order to be sure that we get all the information that's available.
This group was appointed by the Secretary of Defense, and I believe they all serve on the Defense Planning Board.
I'm told that that's true, too, and that's kind of a shadowy group, and their responsibilities and who has been on that board I don't think has been made entirely clear to the public. I don't think there's an attempt to hide that, but, you know, this is the same organization, as I recall, that Mr. Richard Perle, the infamous neoconservative, has been a part of as well.
No, I'm not sure infamous, he would accept that, but anyway.
Okay, I don't mind whether he accepts it or not.
The question of the investigations, though, do they, in your opinion, and particularly the Schlesinger investigation, does it go far enough up the chain of command, and does it pin responsibility where it belongs?
Of course not. There are questions about what role the White House played in all of this. To begin with, Mr. Gonzalez, who is a staffer in the White House working for the President of the United States, wrote a paper about the applicability of constitutional law or international law and the Geneva Accords. Some of this information has also been written about in the Department of Defense among civilian leadership. It had been criticized by uniform lawyers. Some of this information, I'm told, has found its way onto hard drives in Abu Ghraib prison. There is more to this than just the uniform people, and it needs to be smoked out. And it appears, again, from Mr. Hirsch's discussions that have come to light here very recently, that there were people in CIA that were concerned about this and raised the issue with Ms. Rice at the National Security Council, and this in turn was raised again to Mr. Rumsfeld. So there are a lot of unanswered questions, and certainly the role of the CIA in all of this, and what are those the responsibilities of the CIA with respect, first of all, to ghost prisoners, and secondly, to interrogation techniques. I think there's a lot of questions that need to be answered.
We're speaking with retired General Joseph Hoar. He's referring, of course, when he talks about Hirsch, to Seymour Hirsch, the reporter for The New Yorker magazine, who broke some of the allegations about abuse at Abu Ghraib and has just published a book about his investigations over the weekend. He's been on some of the talk shows discussing his findings. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And while we have General Hoar on the line, joining us now is retired General Charles Horner. He was a member of the panel headed by James Schlesinger that investigated prisoner abuse in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He joins us by phone from his home in Shalimar, Florida. General Horner, good to have you on the program.
Hello, Neil.
Do you think that it needs to be a 9/11 style investigation? Do you think that the Schlesinger investigation goes far enough?
Well, obviously I'm tainted because I was part of the panel, but I think Joe's reading too much into what he doesn't know. We looked at 13 different major investigations. Some of them were very narrow. Some of them were very wide. We reported on the abuse, and the abuse is, we shouldn't get confused. We get hung up on the abuses where the pictures were taken. Those prisoners were abused by sadistic individuals, and they weren't even, only one of those prisoners was being interrogated. But we did find where people were straying from the field manual with regard to how the treatment of prisoners in a number of cases, a large number of cases.
And so the question then of systemic difficulties arises, and, well, some people, and General Hoar, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but some people trace it back to the White House and the suspension of appropriate rules for interrogation going back to al-Qaeda prisoners that then infected Afghanistan and then on into Abu Ghraib. The Schlesinger report documents that, does it not, General Hoar?
I think you miscast it. The prisoners in Guantanamo are not covered by by the Geneva Convention. They don't wear uniforms. They don't do the things that gets one's credit under the Geneva Convention. Nonetheless, the White House directed that they be treated humanely and to the extent possible compatible with the Geneva Convention. So that's kind of a red herring. There were abuses, but the abuses generally fall in two categories. One is criminal behavior. Then there's abuse. For example, at Guantanamo, a prisoner bit a guard and took a chunk out of his arm, and the guard hit the prisoner in the face, and the guard was punished under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So that's a case of substantiated abuse where punishment was needed out. But to try and create this aura that there's this massive plot of people committing abuse because of guidance or pressures is just not right.
That's General Charles Horner. General Hoar, do you agree?
I'm not sure that I agree or not. I've known Chuck a long time, and we've been friends for a number of years. I think the point is that we don't know about this. We have people like Senator McCain, for example, that don't seem to be satisfied with the answers. Jack Reed, a whole bunch of people that have received the testimony from the panel on which General Horner just completed his time. I think there are unanswered questions, and I think those questions need to be put to bed. I agree with everything that General Horner has said with respect to the specific abuse of prisoners. The question, I think, is the much larger one about whether or not there are systemic problems that stemmed from an earlier time when political decisions were made what to do with prisoners, the identification of enemy combatants, how they would be confined, how they would be interrogated. I think those are much larger issues, and the role that the CIA plays in all this.
I agree 100% about the role of the CIA. We were unable to get into their investigation. They have an internal investigation going on, and I don't know what they're finding. But with regard to the larger question, the larger questions is the inability of our military to project the kinds of wars we're going to be fighting in the future. We were ill-prepared to handle the number of detainees we had in terms of doctrine, in terms of training, and in terms of our organization. That's a finding we put out in our report. Now, that doesn't mean the people that failed to do that were stupid. Certainly, they've been trying their best. But nonetheless, it's a brand new ballgame out there, and we wound up with thousands of detainees that we didn't expect. We expected to have enemy prisoners of war. Instead, we wound up with rapists, with murderers, with terrorists, with foreigners, with people who were trying to, in their view, be patriotic and throw us out of their occupied country.
We're talking with two retired generals about Abu Ghraib. If you have questions, 800-989-8255. Back after a break. This is NPR News. Today we're discussing the prisoner abuse scandal and efforts underway to reform the system. We'll find out more about whether what investigations have thus far uncovered about abuse at Abu Ghraib and other places, and also whether there needs to be a 9/11 style commission to follow up on the investigations. Our guests are the senior editor of Newsweek magazine, Michael Hirsch, also with us two retired generals, Joseph Hoar, who was a Commander-in-Chief of Central Command, and General Charles Horner, retired Air Force General and the Allied Air Force Commander during the First Gulf War. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. And let's get a question in from a caller. Marcus is on the line from Tampa, Florida.
Hi. I had a quick comment to make. I was a former military lawyer, and My shake on how far the responsibility goes is essentially, I think it goes to the top, to the White House, unless and until you can find a lower level of the chain of command that might have exceeded their authority in some of the rules or behaviors that were allowed at Abu Ghraib and the other areas. Second, I would say, just based on some of my perceptions, I think there's a climate that's existed in this administration based on some of the distinctions that they try to draw with enemy combatants and exclusions from the Geneva Convention and treatment of certain folks, which has created sort of a free-for-all climate in the war on terror and in the treatment of these folks, and that it has we've got good folks in the military who try to do what's right, but when you kind of you get an end justifies the means attitude kind of running fast and loose from the top, I think that it can purvey down. And I'll just take any response off the air.
Okay, thank you. Marcus, thanks very much for the phone call.
Let me respond to that, Chuck Horner.
Okay, General Horner, go ahead.
Well, he's right in his generality, but wrong in his specifics. In this case, it was not fast and loose. In fact, it was very tight. There was the legal counsels, Office of Legal Counsels, came up with the 24 exclusions that Secretary Rumsfeld approved for use against the terrorists in Guantanamo. And only two cases were those, some of those used, and they included things like poking somebody in the chest. Then those were lowered to 19 when the military lawyers finally got into it. And they were excluded at first by an individual in the Pentagon, a civilian lawyer. But they finally got their voice heard, and it was taken down to 19, which had no offensive operations. And then eventually the whole thing was thrown out because it was creating ambiguity.
Michael Hirsch of Newsweek, yeah. what General Horner just said is accurate, but then there are allegations that there was sort of a green light sent to units based in Afghanistan, then later in Iraq, that the gloves were off.
Well, that's right. There's no question about it. There are memos. There is a memo, actually, that says that we're going to take the gloves off, gentlemen. I find myself a little bit mystified by some of General Horner's comments in that his own report, the Schlesinger Commission report, says in black and white that there was contamination. And, of course, General Kern concluded the same thing by contamination or migration. I mean, techniques and approaches in Afghanistan, which was not covered, where the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda were not covered by Geneva Convention for Protection of Prisoners of War to Iraq, where supposedly they were covered. The Schlesinger Commission says, in fact, that that General Sanchez, the head of Joint Task Force 7, actually used reasoning from President Bush's memorandum of February 7, 2002 in creating distinctions that should not have existed because Iraq was supposed to be under the Geneva Convention. So, the reports themselves do point in this direction of responsibility going up to the very highest levels of government.
Well, I think you've mischaracterized what I just said. There's no doubt about it. There was abuses in Afghanistan and Iraq, and there was ambiguity. I said that. And part of the abuses, and these are not significant, these are not the stripping of prisoners. These are other things, originate because of that ambiguity, and that's something that has to be fixed.
Let's get another caller on the line. Tom joins us from Sherwood, Alaska, or Arkansas? It's AK.
It's Arkansas.
Arkansas, go ahead.
Okay, well, first of all, I had the pleasure of serving with both of these gentlemen. I've met them both personally, General Horner at a place called Cornet Aspen and General Hoare at Parris Island. And my brother, who is currently a brand-new lieutenant in the Marine Corps, is finishing up infantry platoon commander school. And he's going to be heading over there. And I'm just wondering, in the long term, what is the impact this is going to have on the safety of the troops and how we're going to counteract any negative impact it has had?
General Hoare, do you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, I'd love to, because I think that's at the heart of this whole issue. The whole history of the Geneva Accords has been to try and protect prisoners of war, and most especially our prisoners of war. And the long, sad story of prisoner abuse in this country goes back to the Revolutionary War, when British soldiers shot American prisoners on Long Island in the first year of our Revolutionary War. And I think all of us are familiar with the prisoner abuses that existed in the Second World War, and particularly in the Pacific Campaign and in Korea and Vietnam, and to some degree even in both Gulf Wars. The point is that Geneva Convention is important for the protection of American servicemen and women, And this is why so much of this is key. And this is really, in part, my concern, that we don't want to do anything that is going to be used as an example sometime in the future of why it is okay to abuse American prisoners of war.
Well, Joe's right, except the fact that our prisoners have been abused and are being abused. There's another side to this. We have to... Some people view any kind of interrogation as abuse. And unfortunately, in a war on terror, your best source of information is interrogating captured terrorists. And so we've got to wind our way through this so that we have effective ways of interrogating people without committing abuse.
I think Chuck is right, but there's some serious problems in my judgment with that line of reasoning. And to look at the British experience in Northern Ireland and the French experience in Algeria, and how this idea of dealing with terrorists leads to the compelling requirement to extract information on a timely basis from prisoners. I'm reminded of that great movie, The Battle of Algiers, of which the French army won. They lost the war and they lost their honor over torture of prisoners. And at the heart of all of this discussion is how do we deal effectively with prisoners, with potential terrorists, with people that look like terrorists that may have done nothing wrong except that they were picked up in a sweep. These are hard questions, and I confess I don't have the answers, but the answers to these questions are important, and to the degree that there has been abuse, and I'm not sure the degree of the abuse beyond what's obviously been documented in Abu Ghraib by these people, which was as much a fault of their superiors as it was for them, as far as I'm concerned. The fact of the matter is we need to get this business behind us and get some clarity about who is responsible and how we're going to go forward.
Tom, thank you very much for the phone call.
Thank you. It's a pleasure serving with both of you. You are wonderful officers and great commanders.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Hirsch, before we let everybody go, what's next in terms of the investigations? Is more coming public, or are there more hearings scheduled?
Well, there's not going to be much until after the election, frankly. A number of Democrats on Capitol Hill were a little perplexed that Senator John Warner, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, scheduled only one day of hearings, even though you had thousands and thousands of pages of new documentation coming out in these reports. I think, you know, there's a suspicion that they're trying to basically put this on hold as best they can until after the election. But that said, I don't think it's going to go away. I think that the calls for, you know, a 9/11 style commission are going to continue because of all these unanswered questions we're discussing right now.
Michael Hirsch, senior editor at Newsweek, thanks very much.
Thank you.
General Charles Horner, we thank you for your time today. I know you're probably in the path of that hurricane. Be careful.
We're boarding up. Thank you, Neil.
Appreciate it. General Charles Horner and General Joseph Hoare was also with us. You're on the West Coast. You don't have to worry about hurricanes.
That's correct, Neil. Thank you.
Appreciate your time today. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.